And Kate Braestrup and her husband Drew had a good life and a plan in the works for an even better one. See, Drew was going to retire from the Maine State Police Force in the next 15 years and then start a second career as a Unitarian Universalist minister. And Kate would continue her work as a writer. The kids would be grown by then, and as she said, it would have been a fine life. That life, however, was not meant to be. One afternoon in April that year, Drew was killed in a car accident. And so Kate found herself a widow, raising four children. Now, many of us have heard, and I've even taught about the so-called stages of grief, which sound orderly and civilized. There is some comfort in this idea that there could be orderly steps, and if you just go through them one by one, then at the end of them, you'll be done. Although I mostly think it's comforting for people who are watching other people grieve, because those who are grieving already know that it is anything but orderly. I've decided recently that grief is more like having a bully hanging out with you all of the time, just waiting there, threatening to take over and cloud whatever else might be going on, demanding your attention, reminding you by its obnoxious presence of what is starkly absent. The writer William Bridges writes about the experience of transitions, which is another way of thinking about grief and loss as a transition. He says there are five aspects of any ending. And again, I know aspects is entirely too tidy of a word, but stay with me because I think this is a little more on point than the stages idea. So Bridges' five aspects are disengagement, dismantling, disidentification, disenchantment, and disorientation. I appreciate that all of these start with dis, because it reminds us that endings are about taking away. They are about what isn't, about lack. Disengagement, dismantling, disidentification, disenchantment, and disorientation, especially disorientation, especially about the future as it had been imagined and will no longer be. This is how Kate Braestrup was feeling when her husband and father of her four children was just suddenly gone, disoriented, confused, lost in the vast landscape of grief and heartbreak, the imagined future dissolved, and in its place, nothing. Yet, all of us will come to this moment at one point, and likely many points in our lives. For to be alive is to be at risk for heartbreak. If it's not already a done deal, it's in the works. The question is not if our hearts will break, but more how they will break, and how we will live in the midst of that brokenness. Will our hearts break, as Parker Palmer says, into 1,000 shards that become an unresolved wound that we carry with us for a long time? Or will they be broken open into a greater capacity for empathy and tending to the suffering of others? We can stay lost in all sorts of ways, or the experience of being lost can lead us to discovering a new way for what it means to be found. Discovering even more of who we are and what our life is calling us to be and do. A year after her husband died, her husband, who had, remember, hoped to retire from policing to be a Unitarian Universalist minister, a year later, Kate Braestrup enrolled in a nearby seminary with the intent of becoming herself a Unitarian Universalist minister. She'd tell people when they'd ask about why she'd enrolled, all of a sudden, as if out of nowhere, she'd say, "I'm here because Drew isn't." As she describes it, she says, "Mine is a sweet little story, one that has what my journalist father used to call a great hook. When local newspapers run human interest pieces about me, they inevitably tell the tale of a plucky widow taking up her husband's standard and bravely soldiering on. It was a sweet story, but it was not entirely true. Because more than just picking up Drew's calling, in fact, she was following then her own. For Drew's death stirred up something in her, a sort of brokenness and disorientation that created in her a new longing. So that when she said she was there because Drew isn't, it wasn't actually just a note about his absence, not just disorientation anymore. Instead, it was cause and effect. Because Drew had died, a new calling had been born in her. Because she had been so lost, she was also newly found." A few weeks ago, I mentioned how my son Joseph is named for the youngest brother in a story in Genesis, where Joseph becomes the ruler in Egypt. You might know this story, even if you don't know Genesis, because it's the basis of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. It's kind of like that. Few less songs. So Joseph becomes a ruler in Egypt after his brothers try to kill him and sell him into slavery. At the end of this story, his brothers come to see him, and Joseph forgives them. And he tells them, "What you meant for evil, God used for good." Which, let me translate for you if those words don't quite work. Even if something starts out as terrible or with very bad intent, it can actually end up being a great gift, something that you are grateful for. Which I need us to promise. We will never, ever, ever say to anyone when they are in the middle of feeling lost. We're going to promise together, right here, that we're never going to say to our friends or even to people we don't like that much. When they are in the depths of despair, we're not going to say, "Well, maybe you'll be grateful for this someday." Promise? Because like William Bridges says, disorientation is meaningful, but it is not enjoyable. It is a time of confusion and emptiness when things that used to be important don't seem to matter. We feel stuck, even dead ourselves in a certain way, lost in some great, dark, non-world. And in the midst of this lost feeling, it's never helpful to say anything resembling, "I'm sure this all has a purpose," or "It'll turn out for the good." Because it might have a purpose. It might turn out for the good, but also it might not. And all we do when we try to push for it to be already and inevitably good is discount the lostness, which is all there can be until there's something else. And also, let's agree that just because pain and loss can be redeemed into goodness does not mean that pain and loss are in and of themselves good. I call that bad theology. Which in my book, by the way, bad theology is not a matter of truth. It's a matter of what kind of life does it allow us to live. So just because pain and loss can be redeemed into goodness does not mean that pain and loss are in and of themselves good. It only means that humans are amazing and resilient alchemists, capable of taking bitterness and destruction and creating out of it something beautiful and unexpected and life-giving. Or at least we are a lot of the time. When grace shows up and some mysterious magic meets us there in the midst of it all, and when courageous love does its work on our bruised and embattled hearts, then that something else can begin to take shape. Then we can begin to learn the street names and the mountain ranges that will orient us and give us a new sense of direction in this new land. Which is also to say that sometimes the mess doesn't transform. Sometimes the magic doesn't happen. And I wish I could tell you there was a formula to make sure that it works, but the stages aren't a formula, remember, and the aspects aren't either. And there is a place of being, piece of being found and then lost and then found again that is out of our hands. Anyone who has ever loved or been an alcoholic or addict who keeps returning and returning and returning to their addiction knows what I'm talking about. And as theologian and addiction specialist Gerald Mays says, we are all in our own ways addicted. Rebecca Solnit was obsessed with a question from the ancient Greek philosopher Meno, or at least attributed to him, that goes, how will you go about finding that thing, the nature of which is totally unknown to you? It was her obsession with this question, how will you go about finding that thing, the nature of which is totally unknown to you, that led her to write her book, A Field Guide for Getting Lost, which is what that reading was from that you heard earlier. Rebecca Solnit realized that if we are to become what we are not yet, which is what she thinks that question is trying to get at, and what she believes is a quest that is the heart of life, then we need to travel to places where we have never been, places that we may not even know exist yet. There is no map that we could follow for these most important journeys of life, because if we knew how to get there, we wouldn't need to go. How will you go about finding that thing, the nature of which is totally unknown to you? Now, with cell phones and GPS today, it's harder than it used to be to get lost. But it is at least easier now to concede when it happens. For better or for worse, my children will likely never know how it feels to sit in the back of the car with your parents arguing in the front about whether or not they are lost and whether or not it's time to pull to the nearest gas station and ask for help. I'll let you guess which parent in my family wouldn't pull over. Okay, it was my dad. But I'll confess, my sisters and I did not always help the situation, as we'd be yelling from the back as they'd be arguing, yes, we're lost! We've been driving in circles. We're totally lost, Dad. Pull over. We were a family that spent a lot of time being lost, or at least arguing about being maybe lost. I used to think that my parents didn't have a great sense of direction, but I've come to realize that it was more likely because they didn't have a lot of practice. See, my dad spent most of his growing up years in a small town where he met my mom when they both attended the local junior college. My mom was raised in an even smaller town an hour away, which, at least in that direction, was the next nearest town. After a couple of years in the university across state, they returned to that small town where they met, and they lived there for the next 25 years. Having a good sense of direction requires the opposite of my parents' proclivity for the familiar. It requires becoming comfortable with the mysterious, and learning how to make new markers when the old ones have disappeared. Solnit points out that even though getting lost describes where you are in space, it is fundamentally related to time. Because when you're on a tight schedule, what might otherwise feel like you're just figuring something out, finding those new markers, instead can become a crisis of disorientation. She says, for example, that being off course for a few days or a week wasn't a disaster if you were a traveler in the 19th century. Even though they didn't have maps, let alone cell phones. but the pace of their life imagined that this would be regular and unexpected, that getting lost was a part of becoming found. It's a good reminder for anyone experiencing that feeling of being lost, whether literally or emotionally, that finding your way in space requires taking more time, slowing down, so that we can see, really see the scenery, feel the new possibilities, and allow this new world that we've discovered to really become a part of us, and us a part of it. Now, although it is true what I said earlier, that it is often a mystery how anyone moves from a state of disorientation into clarity and creativity, there are a few things that can make the wayfinding more likely. A few ways that the heart might more likely break open instead of shattering. Things like, I've said, this taking time and slowing down, or doing things that stir up in you joy, or faking it till you make it. That's a real thing. But all of these start with the most important thing, which is to be a lot more like my sisters and I in the back of the car screaming, "We're lost," than the parent in the front, confident that we're just fine. Rebecca Solnit says that even though we worry most about children becoming lost, they're actually way better at it than most adults because they accept earlier that they are lost. So they don't stray far. They curl up in some sheltered place at night, and they know they need help. And my dad, he's not dumb, for the record, and he's not even the most stubborn person that I know. But he does believe that he is the sort of person that figures stuff out. And he's an architect. So he believes he's good at directions. And like most of us, he does not like being wrong or having this all of these ideas about himself challenged. So acknowledging that he doesn't, in fact, have it all under control, that he might indeed be lost, especially in front of his children and his wife, it is not the easiest thing. Only once things got really, really bad, sometimes to the point of having driven in the wrong direction for over an hour, sorry, Dad, would he finally give in? As Gerald Mays says, surrender does not come easily. It has been treated as a noxious concept in our society. We are taught to never give up, never to allow ourselves to be determined by anyone or anything other than our own self-will. We are taught that when things are going wrong, we should try harder, do more. Even if you're going in the wrong direction, at least you're going. But what we know on those family drives and what we know is true in life today is that just because you refuse to believe that you are lost does not alter the fact that you are, in fact, lost. It just delays your capacity to receive the universe's grace, whether in the form of a magical gas station attendant or some other form. And it delays the getting back on your way onto that journey that is already new because you are making it, the calling that is already being created even in the midst of everything you knew falling away. Which brings me, of course, to the state of the world. Now, I'd never tell you that the chaos and disorientation we are experiencing is all for the good, or that we should be grateful. Because remember, we promised. But I do believe that somewhere in the rubble, there are already the seeds of who we are called to become. And if we can acknowledge with clear eyes and full hearts that so much of the time we feel disengaged, dismantled, disidentified, disenchanted, and disoriented, if we can say together, we're lost, we need help. If instead of numbing or burying these feelings, we can, as Parker Palmer says, move directly into the heart of it, then we might be able to learn what this moment has to teach us and come out the other side. For then we might discover the new calling that is already emerging, the new life that is uniquely possible only because of what has been lost. And only then might we and our world be found, already changed and made glorious by the journey. May it be so. And amen.